So 2 Samuel 9 and 10, we've just come off of God making a covenant with David, covenant for David's lineage to be prolonged, for the nations to be blessed in his lineage. We see that that's going to not only be in Solomon, but we also see that it's going to be in Christ. We see that Solomon's going to build the temple. And so we go through that subject matter, and we come into, after it talks about, in 2 Samuel 8:15, it says, "So David reigned over all Israel, and David administered justice and righteousness for all the people." So we get to the close of that section, and then we have chapter 9. And so it's like a remembrance in a sense. David starts to remember something. So what question is asked in verse 1 and why? Is there anyone who's left in the house of Saul? Not that he wants to show Saul kindness, but he wants to keep the covenant that he made with Jonathan. He wants to show kindness for Jonathan's sake. So we know that David made a covenant with Jonathan, or Jonathan made a covenant with David. So why would he want to honor this covenant? Why was the covenant made? Give me a little bit more of a backstory on there. Let's set that up. All right.
Jonathan had chosen David over his father and showed love to David and saved his life.
So we've discussed this at length, and this will be some of the reason why we can move through this fairly fast. But you think about this for a second. Outside of David being a man of God and a man of his word, you think about what Jonathan did for David and then the covenant they made. You think about right after he slew Goliath, Jonathan befriended him. He took him in. Their souls were knit. He gives him his armor. Jonathan was a kindred spirit, regardless of age or whatnot. Jonathan was a righteous man. He was a faithful man. He put his trust in God. And you think about David being pulled from his home and being brought into the house of Saul, not to return to the house of his father, Jesse. Now you've found a kindred spirit. You think about what impact that would have on David when he very quickly is entered into a hostile environment. You think about once he was in a hostile environment, what Jonathan did for him. I mean, Jonathan warned him and warned him, or was looking out for him, or speaking to Saul to ease or abate his anger with David. And there was no need for him to be angry with David, but you know, Jonathan was doing whatever he could to help David in those matters. In chapter 19, he warned David about Saul's plot to kill him and convinced him not to kill him. In 20, he uncovered Saul's plot against David, or worked to uncover Saul's plot against David. And in 20 is where we see the covenant. In 20, towards the end of 20, you see him encourage David while he was on the run. And he reaffirmed God's plan that David would be king. So you think about the relationship that they had. Jonathan recognizes God's plan. And whereas Saul is like, he's taking your throne, he's taking your kingdom, he's taking your rule and your reign, Jonathan is encouraging David that you will be king and I will be right beside you. Think about the impact that that had on David. Now, in the midst of chapter 20 is where you see that covenant. So he says that he will show kindness to him and to his descendants. And so here we have we have David remembering that. So, is there anyone yet, anyone left in the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake? Not only did he have a love, a brotherly love for Jonathan, but the impact that he had makes him think, reminds him, wants to fulfill this. It's not just because he's a man of his word. So I asked, who is Ziba? Okay, he was a servant. A servant in Saul's house, is that what I heard? He's a servant in Saul's house. So you see here that though Saul is gone, he still has servants, he still has property, he still has a house in the sense of lands and whatnot, servants. Who is Mephibosheth? Jonathan's son. So what do we know about Mephibosheth? And I hearken back to 2 Samuel 4. He was. So what did you say, Susan? It is. What's interesting to me, and maybe I'm reading this wrong, I always you know, you learn things as you study this stuff. It always seemed to me that Mephibosheth was born crippled, but it seems to me in 2 Samuel 4:4 it says, "Now Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the report of Saul and Jonathan came to Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled. And it happened that in her hurry to flee, he fell and became lame. And his name was Mephibosheth." Now, I'm not great with punctuation, with literature, but it seems, or sentence structure, but it seems to me that it's explaining who Mephibosheth is and handicap that he's got, but maybe it's explaining how that happened. I don't know. It was just a tidbit of information, if that's the way you read it, that may have been how it happened. Now, correct me if I'm wrong on the sentence structure or the way that's kind of diagrammed, but that was just something interesting to me. This is maybe how he got hurt. If that's the case, this is just another side point, you know. In that day, he lost his father. He lost, or in that near time, I mean, you know, so this is when Ish-bosheth is being murdered, that he's fleeing. So he's lost his grandfather. He's lost his father. Now he potentially is crippled when he's fleeing for what would be his life when Ish-bosheth, his uncle, is killed. You'd think maybe he would show some type of resentment to David. David's taken what could have been his kingdom. You know, he's had all this misfortune. Sometimes we've talked about this before. Sometimes you become jealous or envious of what the other person has that maybe you could have had, or just jealous of what other people have. Anyway, that's just an interesting side point. Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder, and I could be reading more into it, if the nursemaid had taken him to save his life.
Mm-hmm.
Because he wasn't used, because he was already crippled in mm-hmm. his feet and couldn't go to war and couldn't do all this. And so in trying to save his life, she ended up making it worse.
Yeah, so that's the interesting part of this. I don't know if he was already crippled in his feet and then she made him completely lame. I'm not sure the subject matter, but it is, you have this nursemaid who does take him away to save him, in a sense. And there was an understanding of impending doom for Mephibosheth. Now you have the king, the one who has taken the throne, who is now reigning, who's coming back and inquiring about you. So we see in... Yes, ma'am. I honestly don't know. It was a side thought kind of after the fact, but I don't know of any anchor points that would get us with relative ease to that point. I'm not, so maybe somebody else can help on that. That's just not one of those things that I'm well versed in. That's that I don't know bucket right there. You're right. He is old enough to eat at the table, but you know, it wouldn't be uncommon for younger men to eat at the table 10, 11. No, not a child of five. No, this is down the road. You think about all the things that have happened to David, you know, as we continue on, all the things that he's reigned 7 years. Let's see, when Ish-bosheth was murdered, he'd reigned already 7 years. He's further in. You know, he reigns another 33. It's down the road a little bit. You know, imagine how old, a teenager, maybe something like that. It's down the stream of time a little bit. I'll have to look that up. Yes, sir.
Well, he's also from a royal bloodline. So if someone would potentially try to, you know, acquire the throne from David, it would be Mephibosheth. He has the right to say, "I'm from Saul, I'm from Jonathan, I'm from this royal bloodline." David was not from Saul's bloodline. So for David to say, "I'm going to rise or raise Mephibosheth up to..." Sitting amongst the presence of powerful people, it just speaks to David's confidence that he is the king and that God supports him.
Mm-hmm.
His love to honor Jonathan, and just, you know, it doesn't seem like a politically savvy move to try to bring your you know, potential rival Mephibosheth up so high, but he doesn't seem to, that's not talked about. His weighing the political, you know, impact of raising Mephibosheth.
Well, I think about, so David has confidence in God, and God has anointed him. As long as he is doing God's will, God will bless him. So I don't know that David has any concern that Mephibosheth will be able to usurp the throne because of his faith. It is interesting, though, from the dynamics of he comes from the lineage of someone who tried to slay him, who comes from a wicked line, who comes from one who was not the greatest of rulers. He has been shamed or tarnished in a sense because of all that Saul has done. Now he comes from Jonathan. I don't know what type of reputation Jonathan had, but to the fact that he came from an adversary, and David saw Saul as an adversary to an extent, but he was always the Lord's anointed, and he wasn't going to raise his sword against him. But the fact that he came from a shamed house, and that David would exalt him again, speaks to the relationship he had with Jonathan, and how a godly man he was. He was going to keep his covenant, and the impact that Jonathan had on him. It's an interesting dynamic. So what does verse 7 show us about David's character? And Josh has already spoke a little bit about that.
He kept his word.
I mean, not only did he keep his word and he looked after him, but he gave... Well, first we see Mephibosheth. Now, like Josh has said, if anybody were to have a claim to the throne, though David's confident in his reign, doesn't mean Mephibosheth couldn't try to overthrow him somewhere, somehow. But Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, in verse 6, came to David, fell on his face, and prostrated himself. You know, he laid himself bare before him, and David said, Mephibosheth, he said, here is your servant. He is humbling himself in the sight of David the king. He's at his mercy. And he said, he prostrated himself again. He says, what is your servant that you should regard a dead dog like me? This is how he viewed himself. And in light of all that's happened with his family, I can understand that. He didn't view very highly of himself. But then the king called Saul's servant Ziba and said, all that belonged to Saul and all the house I have given to your master's grandson. You and your sons and your servants shall cultivate the land for him. You shall bring in the produce. Basically, you're going to tend to everything that there is. And it says that Ziba had, Ziba had a lot of kids and 20, he had 15 sons and 20 servants. And so, you know, he looked after him. He kept his word. We see again, you know, David and his honor. We see his character, his faith in God, and doing the right thing. Now, we've constantly been focusing on David and his character, especially in comparison to Saul. All right, that's how we've been looking at this. What a great ruler David is. What great faith he has. We should hang on to that as we enter these other things and not lose, we know the end story, but not lose hope in David. Because David's a great character study from the standpoint of you can be faithful and you can make a couple bad choices. You can fall on your face. You can turn away. You can do something wicked. That doesn't mean, one, that you can't come back to God. It does mean you'll have to face the consequences. But it's also something that we should remember, that David is remembered as a man after God's own heart. We remember the sin that he made. We remember some of some of his accolades, but when you say David, most people think Bathsheba. And we'll get to that. But, you know, we focus on the fact that he was a man of faith. He was a man of character. He was a man after God's own heart, even after all this stuff. You know, so we'll talk about not letting one incident redefine us and not holding one person accountable for one very thing. Look at a person's character over their lifetime to understand who they are and what they are. All right. Moving into 2 Samuel chapter 10. So who is, I think I spelled that wrong. I spelled it wrong in the lesson. Who is Hanan, not Hunan? Who is Hanan and who is Nahash? Who said something? I heard something. King of the Amorites. Who? Which one's king of the Amorites? Ammonites. Nahash was the king of, or is the king? It's trick in a nutshell. You're right. Nahash was a king of the Ammonites. He is no longer. Hanan is the king of the Ammonites. So you've got Hanan, who is Nahash's son. Just to get the story straight from looking at this context. What had Nahash done for David? And he says in verse 2, then David said, I will show kindness to Hanun, the son of Nahash, just as his father showed kindness to me. What did he do for him? One of life's great mysteries, right? We have no idea. Just not important to the story, right? Not really. Just I threw that in there as kind of like a red herring. Look, we don't know what he did. We just know that it's mentioned that he did something nice. And from that standpoint, we're looking at what David does to reciprocate the kindness that he showed. So what did David do? He sent some servants to console him. What were David's intentions pure when he sent his servants?
Yes,
they were pure. They were pure. He wanted to return the kindness that was showed to him. What was claimed about David's intentions, though? They were spies. You're going to come spy out the land. We're going to come and overthrow the land. That's what, in order to search the city, to spy it out and to overthrow it. That's verse 3. So, with that in mind, what happened to the servants? Mm-hmm. So, in doing so, what was the purpose? I mean, I can go shave half my beard, and would that mean a lot to y'all, other than I'd look goofy?
He's
humiliating and shaming them. In humiliating and shaming these servants, who else are they humiliating and shaming? King David. And who? David is God's king on earth. He is his emissary. He is the leader of his nation. So in doing this to these servants, he has done this to David. He has done that to God. All right, now, did this change David's attitude? It did. But what does it say about it? Do we see David just rush into war, or what happened? What does it say about him? Ma'am? Not until they did. It just says in verse 5 that when verse 6, and the sons of Ammon saw that they had become odious to David. There's no indication that David rushes into anything. He sees that they've been shamed, but it seems like he has patience or perseverance or temperance or one of those words, that he's restrained himself. But when they see that they've become odious to David, Ammon amasses an army. So they go and hire the Arminians, and they've got this massive army. And so what happens next? Broad strokes, what happens next? They went to war, and who won? Who prevailed? David. David and the Israel prevailed. So you see that they prevailed. They rose up against God, and they rose up against David. And because they amassed an army, David went and it says verse 17, now it was told David, and he gathered all Israel together and crossed the Jordan. And they fought the Arminians and arrayed themselves and met David, and he fought against them. And then the Arminians fled. And it says in verse 19, so the Arminians feared to help the sons of Ammon anymore. They were defeated by Israel. And we'll see what happens to Ammon a little bit later on. But you see here that they arose up against the nation of God, and they were put back down. They were humbled in the sight of God. All because somebody was in King Hanun's ear about David and his intentions. When you can look at David's character, know that he was a man of God, and he meant nothing but respect. All right. That's kind of a backstory to what's going to happen next. Now, this is where we're moving into lesson 13. So, lesson 13. Yes, yes, sir.
Chapter 10 is a great chapter to remember as to communication. When people supposedly communicate, but they impugn motives, it causes problems, whether it's husbands and wives or brethren or whatever. And that's what happens in the first part of the chapter, is that you war. That's what happens in families and churches.
It does. Impugning motives. You know, they're, you know, trying to make somebody out what makes out some, well, what something, some Buddha. Get your words right. Making out something to be different than what it is. You know, you think about them twisting it, changing it, turning it into something else. And this, Hunan could have sent emissaries back to David, could have asked the question, he's listening to somebody's ear about what they think David's trying to do versus looking at what David was doing. And so we can learn from that today. Be careful who you listen to and what counsel that you get. Especially in personal relationships, where you may be able to just go to that person and talk to them. But that's kind of a backstory. All right, so you have this war going on, and then we have dropping chapter 11. You know, they went to war with Ammon and the Arminians. They have defeated the Arminians, and now we're in chapter 11, verse 1. I'm going to read the first 5 verses. Then it happened in the spring, at the time when the kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David stayed at Jerusalem. So they've defeated the Arminians. It seems to me that now spring has come. So there may have been a time elapsed, especially in those times. Going to war during winter time is probably not the most, that's not the smartest thing to do. So when in springtime they all go to war, you see that they go to destroy the sons of Ammon and besiege Rabbah, which we'll see later on is a water city, I think their capital. But David stayed in Jerusalem. Verse 2, now when evening came, David arose from his bed and walked around on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful in appearance. So David sent and inquired about the woman. And one said, is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Elam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? David sent messengers and took her, and when she came to him, he lay with her. And when she had purified herself from her uncleanness, she returned to her house. The woman conceived, and she sent and told David and said, I am pregnant. Here we have a lapse in judgment. Here we have an uncharacteristic moment. We'll talk about that as we go through the lesson. But I want to look at these first 5 verses for a second and focus on them. So first question wasn't worded very well, so I'll add a word here. Where from and at what time did David see Bathsheba? It was in the evening, and he was on the roof of his house. Where was Bathsheba? There you go. We don't know. So we don't know that she's in her. It just says she's bathing. And we all know from history that people bathed in the river. They had bathhouses. She could have been in her house. She could have been on the rooftop. We don't know. And this is one of the things that I think we just automatically assume, or from a young age, you just get in your mind that she's in her house or she's on the rooftop or something. Moving on. Were David's intentions honorable? No. Yeah, give me that disgusted look. Like, no, it's not honorable. Look what he says. It says in verse 2 that the woman was very beautiful in appearance. I don't think you see that. My subjective comment was, I don't think you noticed that by just one glance, that she's beautiful in appearance. But it says in verse 3, so David sent and inquired about the woman. And one said, is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Elam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? It wasn't, she's single, and so he asked her to come to the house. It would have been just as bad to take her, he got 6 wives. It would have been just as bad to take her and do that when they're not married. But she was married. She's not only married, but who's she married to? Uriah. Uriah being who? One of the soldiers. He's one of David's mighty men. One of this elite force that David has put together. But when they tell him, oh, she's married to not only somebody, but she's married to one Uriah the Hittite, one of your mighty men. David's like, it doesn't appear. I'm reading a lot into a couple of verses here. But so David sent messengers and took her. Was there contemplation, consideration? I mean, he found out she was married and he did this anyway. Which makes it that much worse that she was married and he did this anyway. He knew better. Sent messengers and he took her. And when she came to him, he lay with her. Not honorable at all. We'll get to that in a second. Maybe. That's the next question. What are some things that we can learn from 3 and 4?
Keep your eyes to yourself.
Yes. I've got some verses for that. I don't know that we'll get that far, but they're especially when we come to Ammon and Tamar when you think of some things in Proverbs. What else?
6:18 says, flee immorality.
Flee immorality. Well, so, as a king, he has a nation to rule, and he has a commander who commands his armies. How much worse is it that he was there and this happened while his men are gone? And I'm with you there, because I thought about that too. But there is reasons for him to stay behind. But how much worse, and we'll get to those verses, but how much worse is it, you think about today, say a recruiter comes in and recruits a man and sends him off to war and goes and sleeps with that man's wife. We think about that today. So he's older too. So, definitely knew better. Maybe you're saying maybe age may have played a factor in it. I mean, he does go later and fight when they go and besiege Rabbah. But I don't know. There's a lot of reasons why we don't know. I'm not going to say that it was for David to go. He has a commander and he has a nation to rule and to judge. But how much worse is it that you stayed while this man's out fighting for and your honor, for the nation's honor, and for God, and you're here and you do this wicked thing? One of the things I think about is lust is a powerful thing. It can't happen to me. It's not going to happen to me. But there, David is, who's holding him accountable? He's got God holding him accountable. But what other person is there holding him accountable? And he took what he wanted. Lust is a powerful thing. We can all say it's not going to happen to me. Alex said, you know, avert your eyes. You know, you may see something. It's that second glance or that lingering glance. Or you can't help sometimes what you see, especially in like a Walmart. I mean, you just don't know. But that doesn't mean you'd be like, you know, that you just don't do that. I mean, just you avert your eyes. Lust is a powerful thing. So it can cloud our judgment. And once you get into a situation like that, and you'll see this with David, you just feel like you're in quicksand. Just can't get out. You, at any given time, you can stop. You can make a decision to stop. You can make a decision to change. But let's not dissuade or discount lust as a tool in Satan's tool belt. I mean, that is a huge thing. So, yes, sir.
We know that Solomon's downfall was because he had too many wives and led him into idolatry. Solomon?
Yes, sir.
At this point, David already has 7 wives. So the question is, if he's having so many wives cause a problem with the problem taking care of his physical needs, you would think with 7 wives, he would have this problem. He did. So maybe God's plan of one man and one woman was issue behind David asking me why caused him to have problems and issues and seeking to take care of his physical needs.
Well, and not only that, we see it later. There's no way to know for sure, but it talks about when he flees from Absalom, he left 10 concubines behind to keep his house. So not only does he have these wives, but he's got concubines. One man, one woman. And that, we'll get to that from the standpoint of when Nathan rebukes him and talks about the relationship of Bathsheba and Uriah through the imagery that he uses. So, what were the consequences of David's action?
Steve,
yes, sir.
Can I just real quick?
Sure.
You ask what some things you can learn on this?
Yes, sir.
The note it says, David, verse 4, sent messengers. Verse 6, David sent to Joab. Verse 3, David sent to inquire. David misused his authority. And that's what a husband can do, what a father can do, what an elder can do, what an employer can do. You have authority, but you don't have the right to misuse that authority for personal means. Furthermore, Bathsheba, while we don't know anything about her bathing certain situations, but she was a willing participant. So she's not free of guilt. She could have refused, even if it is the king. And then it's her hypocrisy. It says after he slept with her, she purified herself from her uncleanness, which was the law, Leviticus 15:18.
Mm-hmm.
Why go through that? She committed adultery. and people will commit adultery and go sit at church and sing and talk about religion and quote the Bible. It's clearly hypocritical.
I have a question, and I'll get back to it in a second, about her being a willing participant. I have a question about that that we'll I'll bring up in class, and I'll let you respond to it. Because I have a question about her being a willing participant in this based on the terminology used, but that'll be in just a second, if you don't mind me coming back to that. I do think that's a great observation, though, about abusing your power. I didn't even pick up on that, and I think that is great. When you're in a position of power, when you're a boss or a supervisor or something like that, to use that power in a way that is unintended. Don't abuse your authority that you have, whether it be given from God, whether it be given from your in your job or anything like that. Be what David was righteous, be good, strive to do what's right. Especially in the workplace, we see in Ephesians 6, which talks about working as for the Lord. And so be careful with the authority that we have. And you flip that over to the, you know, the husband-wife relationship or parent-child relationship. Don't, you know, use your authority for good. Yeah. Make sure you tell your kids you're wrong when you are wrong. Make sure you show them that you're fallible. Don't just use your authority to abuse, berate, child slave, you know, that sort of stuff. You know, make sure you treat your wife with respect. Don't just run her down, run roughshod over her. Use your authority in the way God intended you to. Now, we'll get back to Bathsheba in a sec. So a couple of things that I wanted to bring up with the few minutes that we've got left is some misconceptions. So these are things that I've heard that you may not have. And in this audience, it wouldn't surprise me that y'all don't hold these same views, but it's things that people have said. I've heard this before. Bathsheba was trying to entice David or anyone who could see her. True or not true? We don't know. I'll ask this question. Where does it say or imply that that's in the text? It's evening. And we don't know what time of evening. Did David lay down in the afternoon and wake up in the evening? Is it more talking about dusk? We don't know. David arose from his bed and walked to the rooftop and saw her bathing. The palace was most likely the highest place in the city. And, you know, he's on the rooftop. And it's the largest of the place, and probably at the highest topography. And I did some digging, and it just got to a point where it's not worth dealing with this in the sense of giving the exact topography of Jerusalem. But it rises up on a hill, and David's house is supposedly on the highest part of the hill, so he can see a long way. We don't know if she was in her house on the roof in the river in a bathhouse. So in saying that Bathsheba was trying to entice David, and people have said that, either from the pulpit or teaching class, I don't see where you can say that she was trying to entice him. also, using these verses to teach modesty. I've heard people talk about that before. She should have covered up. She should have been careful about what she was doing. She's bathing and she doesn't know who can see her, and it doesn't give us any indication she was out in the public. There's no indication that she was easily seen. I wrote this down as if you're in the gym and someone walks into your locker room and they see you changing by accident, is it your fault in what you're wearing? You're where you need to be and doing what you need to be doing. It's them for walking in the wrong place and continuing to look at. And that's the situation here. She's bathing, you know. David's up on his house. He's the one looking. There's no indication she's broadcasting herself. So if somebody walks in on me while I'm changing in the gym locker room, that's on them. It's not on me. I'm not trying to entice them. It's not about I should be putting on more clothes, be careful about who's going to come in there. That's where I'm supposed to be changing, that sort of thing. Doesn't mean you shouldn't teach on modesty. This is just a bad place to go for that. And I have heard people talk about it. I don't know if anybody else has heard that or not, but yes, no. Yeah, it blows your mind. Now, here's this, and I've heard this, and so when I read this, and I'll be curious to hear your response, but I put that Bathsheba was consenting in this. My thought is she was consenting in this. So you said she was a willing participant. All right, so I put that we don't know. And the reason why I put that, and I'll be curious for the response, is it says that David sent and inquired about her. David sent and took her, And when she came to him, he lay with her. It's all on him, his pronouns, not hers. She could have said no. We don't know if the writer intended for that or not. So I just put that we don't know if she was a willing participant or not. He is the king. I just put that we don't know. Now, I'd be curious to know your response. But to me, it seems like it's all he did it. She purified herself, like what Leviticus 15:18 or 18:15. I looked that up too. She purified herself and she went back home. What are your? Because I don't see that. How do you come to the conclusion?
When a man found a woman who was engaged and wanted to lay with her,
mm-hmm.
if she cried out, she was not guilty. If she didn't cry out, she was considered complicit in the deed. Both were punished. There's no indication of any resistance in this case. She could have cried out. In Joseph's case, he's a man, but he flew. He fled, left his garment in fact. She could have fled. So she could have fled. She could have cried out. Look at the difference what happened when Tamar was raped.
Mm-hmm.
Total different attitude, conduct. She begged with him not to do it. He did it anyway. She tore her garments. It was a totally different reaction.
Now,
so I have a hard time believing that she did. She was not.
Well, but that's where I feel like the crux of the matter is. You have a hard time believing that she was consenting. This is written about David and what he did. So could the Holy Spirit have omitted anything about Bathsheba to focus on what David did, because he is the anointed one, he is the one who was God's king, and this is the sin that he committed, is my question. I mean, I see where she could have been consenting, but the absence of any approval or disapproval to me doesn't give us enough information to say that she was consenting.
If she cried out, he was going to save her from the king.
Well, I don't want to get into the ifs. I mean, she could have cried out. I mean, if you're getting raped and nobody's around, you're still going to scream, hoping somebody's going to hear you. I mean, and he has power over her. She should have cried out. There's no doubt about she had ramifications. But if in the text it doesn't say that she cried out or anything, it omits that. I'm curious. And so, your thoughts?
I'll give it to you.
Okay, that's fine.
There's nothing that says he violated her culture. There is that terminology with Tamar.
Mm-hmm.
There's a suggestion of that with Dinah, with Shechem. There's nothing in the language of Deuteronomy 22. There's language to the idea of that force. There's nothing in this text about that.
Okay. And those are good points. I agree with you, because you see what happened with Tamar and you see what happened in those other situations. Rocky, you look like you have something to say. Yes, sir. Okay. No, I appreciate it. Now, so this is one of those things that it's hard to understand from the text. I think that you can read it both ways. In my notes, when I talked about it being a misconception, I put, we don't know. It's for you to decide that. It's for you to come to that conclusion. That does not mean you need to believe me, because I may believe this today, but it's really easy to read this and think that she was a willing participant. I think the greater context here is what David did. I don't want to lose focus of, was she a willing participant or not? Because this is where we get off track. The story is not about Bathsheba. This is about what David did. Was she a willing participant? Wasn't she a willing participant? What are we talking about? We're talking about David's sin. The fact that David lusted after her. David called her. David slept with her. So I think we get off into the weeds talking about Bathsheba a little bit to that extent. Yes, ma'am. She did. She did. Now, he faced more consequences, but again, the story is written about David and what he did as the Lord's anointed, as the stories go through, because this has ramifications with the kingdom. But she did face consequences as well. Yes, sir.
Just about the word unclean, how she had to cleanse herself from her uncleanness.
I guess it's kind of, I'm not too familiar with the Mosaic law. Would she not have been unclean if she was raped? If she had cried out, stop, but she was proceeded to be raped, would she still have been unclean and needed to go through that process?
She should have. Well, you see that. We'll get to it when we talk to Amnon and Tamar, but we see where Amnon put Tamar out right away. She shouldn't have been put out right away because she was unclean. So when we talk about Leviticus 15:18, just to give an understanding of what this is, if a man lies with a woman so that there is a seminal emission, they should both bathe in water and be unclean until evening. She purified herself and then went back to her house. That's what we're talking about. When you're raped, most likely they're not going to let you stay till evening. Again, this, if she was allowed to purify herself and then go home, may give an indication that she was consenting, or at least David was allowing her to do such thing. If you were raped or an unwilling participant, maybe you would want to run. So
raped or consenting, either case, afterwards, if someone wanted to be right, they would need to have purified themselves because they weren't clean. They would say, oh, I shouted out. Yes, I was great, but I shouted out. I'm not unclean. There's a seminal omission. There is lame. It's unclean. Raped or consenting.
Yes, I don't. The unclean, I don't want to get too far off, may not mean that you're sinful. It may just mean that you're dirty, in a sense. Unclean in that way. But okay, so I knew this was going to kind of happen when we talk about this, but I intended for that, and that's why we allotted a little bit of time tonight. I don't want to get too far off on was she or wasn't she a willing participant, but it is a good thing to look at. And I think that you should read it and study it very well, but take away from it that we're talking about what David did. You know, I mean, we can learn that from, we can learn something from Bathsheba, but there are other places we can go to talk about sexual sin in that way, if you're going to commit adultery or those types of things, especially from that perspective. But we don't want to lose sight of what David did, because this is a story about what David did, because it's not just, it doesn't end here. It doesn't end here with him taking Bathsheba and laying with her. She gets pregnant. And then what does he do after? And what does he do after? And what does he do after? The story is written about him because this will change the course of the kingdom and what will happen. It enters a very tumultuous time afterwards. So that's all the time we have. We'll pick back up on next Wednesday on lesson 13. And don't forget, lesson 14 is in the back for that following Sunday. But we've got the meeting this coming Sunday.